This is a Rally Week in Review for May 25th, 2009. I'm James Turner, contributing editor at O'Reilly Media. In this edition of O'Reilly Week in Review, we'll be talking to the authors of two O'Reilly books. First, we'll talk to Damian Stolarz about the interesting things he's learned to do with an iPhone, and which is documented in his book, iPhone Hacks. We'll also hear Jennifer Green and Andrew Stellman talk about what they've learned about beautiful teams. To start this week, we talked to Damian Stolarz, who's the author of the iPhone Hacks books, who explained to us some of the interesting things that you can do with your iPhone. Why don't you start by talking a little bit about what is an iPhone hack?
O'Reilly kind of defines hacks as a clever solution to an interesting problem. And an iPhone hack is when we take something that you want your phone to do, and it just doesn't do out of the box. And through software changes or hardware changes or what have you, we make it do it.
A lot of people, I think, would equate on an iPhone a hack being equivalent to something that required you to jailbreak it. Is that always the case, or is there a lot of stuff that can be done to just a base iPhone without making Apple unhappy with you?
Correct. You can do a lot of stuff without jailbreaking. We have, in the book, we have two chapters, chapter 11 and 12 are on programming and on hardware. And for instance, we were able to, connect the keyboard to the iPhone without jailbreaking.
To a USB keyboard or?
We used, some of the PDA keyboards that, were popular for Palms and PDAs a few years back. But we've adapted it to a couple different devices. So a keyboard, we used an infrared receiver. We were able to, connect a remote control that could be received by the iPhone and a keyboard. And we can do pretty much any device we wish. We're actually working on trying to get a USB keyboard working as well.
The iPhone, like most of the Apple product line, it's fairly easy to get into being a software developer on it. It's essentially give them $100 and you're in. Do you think that for the average kind of, obviously not consumer, but more tech-savvy person, it's worthwhile to make the investment so you can play around with it?
Absolutely. And actually, you can begin to play with it without even doing the $100. The $100 gets you to the next step where you can actually put the code you've written on your phone. But yeah, I think it's totally worth it because to some degree you pay that $100 and now you can write any program you want and put it on your phone and distribute it to 100 of your friends. So it's, even a lot of the restrictions of, I got to go through the App Store. If you're doing hobbyist programming or if you're doing productivity programming, I know people who are doing little adaptations where they take their phone and they use it as a data collection device. They're writing programs that enable the phone to do what they want it to do. And since it's for personal use, they don't have to go through the App Store and all that business.
As far as hardware goes, for a lot of people, I think they would look at it and somewhat like the iPod, but even more, it really is a sealed unit that you need to know the mojo to get inside. If you're willing to do a gut check and open up your iPhone, for example, 3G, what are some of the cool things you can do once you've got it open?
Well, you're kind of right in that sense. Once you open it up, there's not much. It's such a tightly packed device that it's kind of like, wow, it's kind of like opening the human body up. It's not something you really want to do unless you're trying to learn what's inside. I guess the only thing that I think general consumers might have some benefits is if you open the phone, you can adjust the focus on the lens so that you can actually zoom in. So if you want to permanently modify your phone to make it nearsighted, that's one little hack you can do. And then you can take pictures of business cards and take really nice pictures of things up close. But you can also buy a case from one manufacturer that has a lens on the outside that accomplishes the same purpose. So as far as cracking it open, I guess the only other thing is if you take it apart, it's easier to color the faceplate and the various pieces. So you can stain your iPhone or permanently color it different colors. But in general, once you open it, it truly is, besides replacing the battery, there's not much user serviceable parts inside.
I've replaced batteries on my iPod. I've heard the iPhone is a more challenging battery replacement.
Yes, it is, and it was harder on the first gen. The second generation, or the 3G rather, is much more forgiving to work on. I think a lot of the initial, like, what the heck, came from taking apart the 2G and just, you almost always bend the aluminum case. You know, it's just a really rough device, but they really fixed that on the 3G, and it's not that hard to take it apart and do stuff to it. It's just like we said, there's not much you can do except replace the battery. But for those people who are repairing their iPhones, it's totally worth it. If you wind up with two dead iPhones, one with a cracked screen and one with a dead brain, you can combine them into one working phone. And sites like iFixit.com sell the individual pieces. So there's a lot of do-it-yourself repair of phones if you're outside of warranty or you just don't want to go back to Apple and you want to fix what you've got.
So one of the things that people love to do when they have software access is drop something totally different onto a device. So you've got, you know, people drop Linux onto things all the time. How much of that has there been done with the iPhone? I mean, to some extent, once you replace the operating system, it gets a little difficult because the underlying hardware for the phone kind of is very dependent on the OS. But has anybody looked into doing something like sticking Android on an iPhone?
So in our book, we actually mention and document a little bit of the status of a Linux port. And the Linux port is interesting and amusing, but like you said, it's arguably pointless. Your iPhone is already running a really nice form of BSD Linux with a mock kernel, i.e., you know, OS X. And I think those kinds of ports are a little senseless. I think most of the porting that has been done that is exciting to people is video game emulators. And we actually dedicate a whole chapter to that. But pretty much there's no video game that you can't run, you know, from 80s and 90s consoles. I mean, you can run everything to PlayStation 1 games, so the original PlayStation, various Game Boys, Nintendos, Super Nintendos, almost all those game systems have been ported to the iPhone, and those are the kinds of environments that can be easily emulated because you have basically 400 megahertz on the iPhone, and that gives you enough headroom to do all the old consoles. Just as far as porting Android or Windows Mobile, it's one of those things that would be so Herculean an effort. Android's the most likely because you have source code access, but I think it would just like Linux, it's one of those labors of love that they're just not getting that many volunteers. And in a capitalistic sense, that, you know, the even the hackers have focused on jailbreaking first for the purpose of unlock. I mean, even if you watch what they did, right, they focused on the phones for unlocking, you know, meaning SIM unlocking. And then they went back and did the iPhone 2G, but the whole community waited 6 months or so for the for the iPod 2G, and it just wasn't on the top of their list because obviously the prize was to jailbreak the 3G iPhone, and then once they jailbroke that and unlocked it, then they went back and figured out the iPhone. So there's just, you know, when you're recruiting the elite hackers of the world, you know, Android to the iPhone is way down the list.
There's been a lot of controversy lately about the somewhat arbitrarily manual way that the App Store works in terms of what's approved and what's not approved, and some talk about how the refund policies work. Is the Palm or the Android model for app merchandising a better model, do you think, than the way Apple has run things? Do you think Apple is going to have to change in the long run?
There's no question that Apple will change in the long run. It's how long that run is. But whether it's a better model really depends on what your criterion for better is. So if you're looking at market, Apple has created the largest, you could liken it to a controlled economy. And to me, I kind of draw parallels between the massively multiplayer online games for years, the EverQuest, and then later the Ultima Online's the EverQuest, and then in the last few years, the World of Warcraft. You know, you sort of have this virtual economy that's completely controlled by one company. Apple has done the same thing. The difference being, this is a real world economy, and it's a billion-dollar economy. So I would argue that from a financial perspective, Apple has the ultimate solution and has made the most successful app store of all time. And I would also argue that the grumblings about it are frustrating. But if you really look at Apple as the mega distributor, it is no different than any of the captive environments that we're used to. So if you're a musician and you go to Hollywood, or you go to Nashville, only a few people hit, and there's gatekeepers, and there's A&R, and there's this whole myriad of mess, and there's so many gatekeepers, and only a few people hit it. And then you take the same analogy and you go into movies. Apple has basically translated sort of the entertainment elite experience. You could be a star also, but only a few make it. And they've translated that to the application space. It's different than the internet, which is unfettered. Anybody can try something, anybody can win. But in another sense, they've created a multi-billion-dollar economy. So it's just hard for me, an individual who's kind of looking at it in a holistic sense and has had a lot of his own fortunes rise because of this, to be overtly critical of someone creating a huge multi-billion-dollar playground or game for me to play in. Does that make sense?
So we've been talking to Damien Stowars, who is the author of O'Reilly's iPhone Hacks book. Thank you for talking to us.
No problem.
One of the more recent books that's come out in O'Reilly's Beautiful series, which includes such books as Beautiful Code and Beautiful Data, is Beautiful Teams. We spoke last week with Jennifer Green and Andrew Stellman, the authors of the book, about what goes into making a beautiful team. Can you begin by just saying what the basic impetus for the book was?
Beautiful Code had been doing really well, and we thought, wouldn't it be great to do something like that for teams? That was pretty much how it started. Right, Jenny? Something like that?
Yeah, I mean, Andrew and I were thinking about doing another book at the time, and they had just gotten done with the Beautiful Code anthology, and they wanted to follow it up with something else. They, you know, we being project management people thought that, you know, a book around management would be really interesting. So many people have different opinions of why teams work and why they don't work that we thought it would be a fun thing to try to explore with some people who had really different experiences throughout the industry.
There are obviously lots of case studies and examples and anecdotal evidence about bad teams. You don't hear as much about really good teams, maybe because they're rarer. What do you think are the kind of central nut factors that make a team really great?
I was going to say that there are a few themes that kind of keep coming up through the course of the book. And it's interesting, even the stories that are about bad teams kind of resonate. They kind of say the same thing, which is that, you know, when people are able to kind of be honest about what they want and their motives and kind of get other people to buy into the vision that they have, that's when you get a team that gels.
And right.
Sorry, go ahead.
There's also being smart. And by smart, we usually, what we mean is making good decisions and making decisions consistently so that that people can even if they disagree with what you, as a team leader or as a team member, but having to make decisions, they can agree with your reasoning and your ideas. And the idea, that sort of core idea of being genuine and being smart, just you know, truthful and honest and open and transparent, but also predictable and making good decisions, just came up over and over and over again.
So, I mean, it's a lot about leadership, right? Because even a team, some of the stories in the book are about teams that manage to kind of hang together despite the fact that leadership is kind of not necessarily following any of those guidelines. It can happen, but boy, it's a lot easier when team leaders are able to kind of follow those basic tenets.
Oh, by the way, you know, something that you said, I wanted to not take issue with, but raise a little bit, which was that the idea that there's so many more bad teams than good teams. And I think I'm not saying that that's wrong, although I would like to believe it's not right, quite true. But sometimes I get the feeling that software people feel like so many projects go awry, or maybe so many teams are bad, because and this is actually one of the sort of, I mentioned that Why Projects Fail talk we were doing. It's one of the core ideas of that talk, is that software projects fail over and over again. And that's actually, you were asking what led us to this book. Well, when we were doing that talk, where we just went around to lots of different groups, project managers, software architects, core, hardcore engineers, developers, programmers, process improvement people. And we just went through, we'd found over the course of our careers, especially this is something that came up in our first book, Applied Software Project Management, that software projects, you know, there's an old saying, there's a million ways to fail, but only one way to be right. Well, software projects, it turns out that software projects kind of go wrong the same way over and over and over again. And it was, and when we took a minute to talk about it, and we just took it on the road. And as we were talking to people, we just got these war stories. People really, you know, we weren't really sure how it would be received, because people don't, you know, get a little uncomfortable talking about failure, but they, you know, we got this great response. And people would give us these war stories and loves to talk about their teams. And what we found a lot was that, it wasn't as much the team would especially when their projects fail, especially when there are obstacles, especially when they ran into a brick wall, the teams would actually be drawn together. And even when the project ultimately failed, a lot of times we'd find the same, the people would be in touch and still friends years later because of that shared, you know, terrible experience. And even if the project failed, I would call that a great team. If they manage to conquer adversity and form such strong bonds with each other, that turned out to be one of the core ideas in Beautiful Teams too.
A lot of the meritable attributes you talk about, transparency, ownership, those are kind of the keystones of the original Agile process. We've seen Agile and Scrum presented as the latest and greatest magic bullet, and they've kind of been co-opted as the great new management technique. Are Beautiful Teams succeeding because management is adopting these, or in spite of it?
We found it wasn't so much about, I mean, Andrew, you can jump in if you think I'm saying the wrong thing, because I haven't really thought about it in this way, to be honest, but I think that one thing that we found is that it wasn't really so much about what methodology you chose, whether you were Scrum or Agile or you know, Waterfall even, because practices were really there to kind of support the vision that you were trying to, you know, get the team to work through, right? And practices can sure make things easier. Practices like, you know, code reviews and whatever sort of methodology supporting thing that you do in your project, that it's important, but it's not everything. And having really great practices doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a successful team or a successful project.
To finish up, if you had to each pick from the book one really beautiful team that you really liked for either the way they did things, what they did, or how they did it.
That's a good question. Well, for what they did, I would probably, honestly, I really like Mark Healy and like Mark Healy's team. He's the guy who runs Media Molecule, who that's the company that that came up with Little Big Planet, which is a fantastic video game. And there's, you know, talking to him, and we have this an interview early in the book talking about, you know, one of the basic ideas of it is just getting the right people. And you can just tell from the way the team came about and evolved and the kinds of things that he does and the way he leads or the way he and his the other team members co-lead, you can just see the joy that you get from the game. The game has so much whimsy and joy and just fun. And you can just tell that so much of that came directly from how they work together. And so I think that was a great team. One of my favorite teams from the book, another one is Jenny's team. She writes about a team only because partially because I know some of the people, Well, Jenny, do you want to talk a little bit about your team or another one if you want?
Yeah, sure. It's a team that I worked on a few years back that was trying to build a natural language processing engine to help people shop for laptop computers. And it was an interesting project because the team was full of really intelligent, smart, motivated people who were doing really great work.
I think smart is an understatement. These people were brilliant. I mean, this was one of the smartest group of people I've ever heard of working on software.
They were super dedicated. We all like put in tons of hours and cared a lot about the product that we were building. But the product itself was kind of not really going to be successful. I mean, the idea of actually talking to a natural language processing engine to configure 5 or 6 different possibilities on a laptop never really flew, you know? So if you look at it kind of objectively, the project itself failed. I mean, it didn't go anywhere. But the team was amazing. We built something that was high quality, that we really cared about and really put ourselves into it and had a great bond and experience where we all still stay in touch with each other and are still references for each other. And it was a great experience, probably one of the best of my career, although the product itself wasn't objectively successful. So that it was an interesting lesson for me to learn. Another one that from the book that really struck me was Peter Gluck's story. He's a NASA person.
I think he was a team manager at NASA for a whole bunch of projects, like ones that you heard of for years and years.
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is, you hear all your life about what it's like to work at NASA. And I know so many times, like, when we would want to put in certain practices, people would be like, this isn't NASA, you know. So, like, to hear
how NASA does things.
Yeah. So to hear how NASA actually did stuff was personally really exciting to me, and it was really interesting because it was such a revelation that they actually do things pretty much like everybody else, you know.
Yeah, it was kind of a problem. I kind of have this feeling of they put their pants on one leg at a time, just like everyone else. You know, they build it the same way, they test it the same way. It's just that they put whole lot more time, money, and effort into testing. And there are some things they can't do. We talked to them, like continuous integration. You know, I asked them, well, do you do continuous integration? Well, no, we don't do continuous integration because, you know, integration means integrating with the hardware platform too, which means you have to take it into a clean room and then load the software up on it. And I think it's pretty safe to say that if your integration process involves a clean room, it probably can't be automated and done every hour.
Yeah, that or they have like a 2-week launch window that they absolutely can't miss their deadlines, and they spend like hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, they have like every problem in software only like elevated much higher than probably most of us have ever experienced.
Because
how they deal with it.
Right. A bug for us means irate customers, maybe even something, you know, a serious client relationship problem, needing some money. But a bug for them means they're never going to be able to, you know, could mean you've got a spaceship or a rover out there that you're never going to be able to talk to again. They just can't afford it. And a national incident too, because you lose a spaceship, it makes headlines. So they don't. Yeah. And it was pretty interesting to hear how they handled it.
That's it for this episode of O'Reilly Week in Review. Join us again next week when we'll speak with more O'Reilly authors about some of the most important topics in the computer industry. Our theme music was composed and performed by Father Rock. For O'Reilly Media, this is James Turner.